Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome. How
Hi.
Are you?
Hi. I'm Kelly, so glad to see you.
You're back.
I know. I was in Hawaii.
You know what I can't believe? I thought I was going to see you either sunburnt or really tan because you have fair skin.
But I am like so, like I literally like am covered like in a hat and like slathered with like sunscreen everywhere. I did get a fake spray tan. So I looked tan before I went and now I'm like just like all gross and white again.
So how was it?
It's so funny. Every time I tell people like, yeah, I went to spring break in Hawaii, they're like, oh my God. I'm like, no. My kids got up at 3:30 a.m. local every single day. Ugh. And I'm not kidding. Like we were there at Denny's and there was like the local Denny's, which they called Zippies. And then like the real Denny's and like all like the Hawaiian drunks and like me and my kids. And like, there I am. I'm sure they were like, why is that parent bringing like two kids at 3:30 in the morning to Denny's? But like literally like up and at them, like ready to go.
But so, they also went to sleep really early.
Well, so this was the funny thing. Like, you know, my husband and I were disagreeing. He's like, well, maybe we should put him to bed later. And I'm like, I don't think that that's going to work. Like, and so we tried it and no, it didn't work. It worked for my older one, but my younger one, the 3-year-old, like still ready to go, like 3:30. So it was still Hawaii, which is what I say. So it was still, you know, cool.
Beautiful,
but,
right?
But it was rough. Like I got back and I was pretty exhausted because it was like when you start the day at 3:30, I mean,
sure.
And it's like you're eating in the dark. It was like so weird, you know, but it was
but then
cool.
You got to get an overnight with David.
So
right?
That after was the best.
Your parents came.
I was so smart to do this. I have to say, I'm just going to tell our listeners because I had planned my parents were coming afterward. And I said, you know what, just in case this vacation just isn't a vacation, which I had suspected, let me call my parents and ask them if they're came in from the East Coast. Let me see if they'll watch the kids for a night. And thank God they did. So my husband and I got, you know, he joked with me. He's like, we had to spend so much money on a vacation to get like a one night vacation. And I was like, exactly.
Are your parents still here?
No, they left. They only came for a couple of days. That was great. So it was fun. It was nice. And then, you know, the kids are back to school and now I can breathe again.
So many of the schools are still off. I think they stagger spring break now. It used to be it was like either the week before Easter or the week after. But now their kids in Ventura County are just out now.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Wonder how it's like in the other parts of the country.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is really interesting. Yeah.
So I have a little update.
Tell me.
Which is actually my pup date because my little seal that we rescued a week and a half ago seems to be doing okay. We get little pup dates from the company. They're just so sweet.
Wait, can you tell did you tell our listeners what happened?
Yes.
Okay,
It was Ventura Boardwalk down at the beach about a week and a half ago. And we're just walking, looking at the squirrels, and then noticed this baby seal that was just stranded. This little baby. I mean, it was tiny, like less than 20 pounds. And just looking out, like looking sort of forlorn. And I'm sure I was projecting all kinds of things. But it wasn't like bopping around and happy and lounging in the sun and doing all that. So it was clearly abandoned. And we got help. And we got the right help. Apparently, and they took it to the shelter and they're feeding it and give us poundage reports on how many pounds of fish. Yes.
And so, you didn't get to pet it or touch it.
No.
They say not to.
Not even close. Like they bite.
Yeah. Oh, really?
They're terrified.
Yeah.
They have lice. They have bacteria in their mouths.
No way. See, I would like be so like Frenching this animal. Like, you know, I'd be like all up in that pup's business. So.
But we helped, you know, with the rescue team and I had to keep the crowd quiet because we didn't want anybody to scare the seal back into the water because once it goes back in the water, there's no hope.
Interesting. Good for you.
So keep fingers crossed and prayers for our little pup we named Peachy.
Oh my God, that's so cute.
She's so cute. Yes.
That is good for you. I'm so impressed that you knew exactly who to call and what to do.
Well, no, we really didn't know. We just sort of went. We just took the effort. We went to the Crown Plaza Hotel and asked somebody there. There happened to be somebody who was working in the area that looked like they were sort of parks and recreation. They knew who to call. So it was just like a really nice team effort.
Fantastic. Good for you.
Yeah, and I felt like it was my... It was rescue week for me last week. I mean, this sort of energy.
Oh, really?
I believe in energies. Like, I helped one of my friends get somebody that she was very worried about into rehab.
Oh my God.
I had somebody reach out to me from a former relationship who was in trouble with somebody who I used to know. And so I won't say anything more about that on air. But yeah, it was a week of, all right, I need a little break now.
Yes, exactly.
Like, or I'm going to need rescue.
Yes, I was just going to say, I'm here. I'll rescue you.
So anyway, good week. Everything's going well. It's good to have you back, as always.
I missed you. I really did. Like, it felt like a long week without the show. Like, I definitely realized how much I love it.
It's like part of our world now.
Yes.
I can't imagine it not being part of our
week. I know. So it felt like I felt naked. I was naked in Hawaii. That's really what's going on here.
So last week, of course, you missed Holly Robinson Pete.
I know.
And Kim Gold. And thank you, Kim Gold, for being the sponsor of our show. Kim Gold wrote a business memoir, Gold Standard, How to Rock the World and Run an Empire. This book is called A Front Row Seat to a Huge Upheaval, not only in her own life, but in American business. I feel like she's just become like part of the staple of the show. Right?
I know.
She always sends us great guests. And
yes.
I have to tell you that if I weren't here last Tuesday, the two of them could have run the show together. Kim and Holly Robinson Pete are really good friends, and they've known each other since they were 13. And Eric Luke.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't realize it spanned
since middle school. So they were just talking and kibitzing as if, like, I didn't really even need to be here. except to run the machine that
running
now.
But that's nice. They good
wonderful.
Chemistry. Cool.
Okay. Well, would you like to introduce our guest for today?
So I'm so excited to introduce our guest today. So we have Linda Powers Levitin. She's an LMFT. So she is the West Coast Director of the Gifted Development Center, a marriage, child, and family therapist. She specializes in assessing and counseling gifted and creative children, adults, and families, and is only one of two people qualified to use the Columbus Group Qualitative Assessment, which provides a sort of user's manual for parents and their children. She was influential in the creation of the visual spatial learning style construct and has further refined understanding of tactile kinesthetic learning style. Her book, Peace Within, Peace Between, Your Relationship Toolkit, is a practical guide to understanding your gifts, challenges, and needs and how to apply them more effectively. So welcome, Linda.
Welcome. Hello.
Hi.
Good to see you all. Thank you for inviting me.
So, and I will tell my personal story. So I have a son who is what they call twice exceptional. I like the name. It just sounds so fancy. But it means when a kid is duly diagnosed. So my older son is diagnosed as gifted intellectually and then has ADHD. So that's what they call twice exceptional. Although you can be two diagnoses of anything, correct?
Correct.
So I went to a twice exceptional meeting, like a meetup, which was fantastic. And I met a lot of other parents who had kids with this similar background. And that's where I met Linda, who was so resourceful and fantastic and has this great book, which we'll talk about too. And so we invited her on the show.
Thank you.
So how did you get involved in this industry?
Well, I grew up with a twice exceptional brother and a sister who is developmentally delayed. And at 12, I was in gifted programs. And at 12, I met the woman who later became the expert in this field. And so for 52 years, I've worked with her, and she became my mentor and best friend. And it was a logical conclusion to my experience of working. I taught as well with all of these gifted kids who sometimes weren't able to show their gifts. And so being able to identify their learning challenge or their social challenge or whatever it is that's stopping them from reaching their potential became an important goal for me, so that these kids could felt seen and heard for what they're able to give to the world, not just what they couldn't do.
Mm. I'm just thinking, like, as you're speaking, how wonderful it is now versus probably when your brother was growing up, where that wasn't even a term. Nobody knew kind of what was going on.
Absolutely. And he was, sadly, part of the reason that I went into this is he was diagnosed with ADHD at 2 and heavily medicated. Mm. The result being, and in those days, he's over 50 now.
Yeah.
But in those days, they gave such heavy medication that he was like a zombie most of the time. And so it broke my heart to watch him grow up with this incredibly sweet child very capable, who eventually, you know, I believe had physical problems as a result of the heavy medication at such a young age.
Oh, that
at
2 years old?
Wow. 2 years old.
I didn't even think you could diagnose a child with ADHD until
like
7.
Well, he was very
so
active
okay.
immediately. I mean, my mother talks about him in the, he was a preemie, mm-hmm. and in the incubator crawling around.
Wow.
So this was a pretty early on. And also, you know, my parents were not educated. They weren't prepared to deal with any sure. kind of out of the norm. And here they got one child who was gifted and then the next two that had mm-hmm. severe and extreme needs outside of the norm.
Wow.
You know, I figured out later in life that I had numbers dyslexia.
I think yeah. my dad has that. How did yeah. you figure that out?
Because I would do something and somebody would say, no, that's not the right order that I just said. So I would be taking down somebody's phone uh-huh. number and I would just do, instead of, you know, 338, I would do 383.
Oh
and I would
God.
Do it so often. So I never got diagnosed and I was never helped or treated with anything. I just became exceptionally attentive when I did math to the point where I got 100% in every statistics test that I had to take in graduate school.
That's
it was
amazing.
But I just would have to test and check my work over right. and over again because I just couldn't trust that mm-hmm. I was
well, and some
right.
of it also could be an auditory challenge, because if they were giving you the numbers mm. in an auditory way, you also could be hearing it and your short-term memory could not have been processing it.
That's it sounds like there's so much at stake. You can't quite tell immediately.
It is quite complicated for some of yeah. these kids. And of course, they only see the world through their own eyes and they hear it the way they think everyone else hears it. And so they're not going to say, well, I don't exactly hear what you're saying. They think right. this is what it's supposed to be like. And so what I do is help parents understand when there's more going on than just laziness or opposition. A lot of times when a child doesn't hear something, they will continue to do whatever activity they've been told to stop, and the parents will interpret it as them just trying to get back at them for saying stop.
Oh, wow. How frustrating yes. for the little munchkins.
And that's the major feeling that most of these kids describe, that their life is incredibly frustrating.
Yes, I could absolutely see this.
So what is this the Columbus Group qualitative assessment? Sounds like a cool thing.
It's an amazing process that was developed originally by Anna Marie Roper, who was kind of the godmother of gifted education. I mean, she died a few years ago in her late 90s. And she did research. She started a school with her husband. And before that, during World War II Germany, her parents ran a school for the gifted. And her premise was that every person needs to be seen for their gifts. And so she developed a way of using interview and information that we later added to it with different kinds of scales that the parents fill out and anecdotal storytelling. And she could interview a child and she could say, okay, this child has an IQ of this much and he's able to excel in this area and this is what you need to do. And she could just sit down with the parents and give them this beautiful explanation of what was going on for the child. Mm-hmm. She did not have a background in learning challenges, however. And so with the Columbus Group and with people who are specializing in twice exceptionality, we used her method to develop a way of doing this gentle, qualitative interview with the child and interviewing the parents and eliciting the information that we needed to infer what was going on. And so the process is a very gentle one. Parents fill out a lot of forms, and then I analyze all the forms. I then meet with the child, and then I meet with the parents, and I tell them what I've learned from the child. And basically, the child just plays with me, and I talk to them, and they love the attention.
I'm sure.
And they are in charge of that whole section. So it's this incredibly different kind of assessment that where the child is not expected to just show what they know. The child is allowed to be who they are.
I love it.
Me too.
That's awesome.
I want to talk a little bit about learning styles.
Sure.
So can you kind of give us the background of that and the basics and all that kind of stuff?
Absolutely. One of the forms and the things that we look at is learning style, because Even though there's a little bit of controversy in the field about it, because it's hard to prove that a person is strongly one or another kind of learning style. But what we found after observing thousands of children, and in particular testing about 6,000 children at the Gifted Development Center, is that some children tend to learn very strongly in a particular way. Mm-hmm. So Linda Silverman, as she'd known me my whole life, and in fact her mother was also a visual spatial learner, she developed a construct about people who learn best by seeing and by using metaphors and by describing things by what their internal picture of it is. Mm-hmm. And it's very different. People who are auditory sequential, which is the other kind, they hear and they turn into words what they need to know. And so they have a very different way of learning. Uh-huh. And those kids tend to do better in school because their short-term memory is better than a visual spatial, and the teachers teach in that way. They tend to lecture, which is auditory. They tend to want sequential learning, so they teach A, B, C, D, and you have to do all of those steps to get to where you want. A visual spatial learner doesn't learn best that way. Right. They learn by being shown something or by trial and error, and they want to know the big picture first.
This is me. I'm so visual. I'm like dying.
Sort of the more creative of the learning styles, but it's a way of learning that means that your short-term memory isn't as good as your long-term. Once you get it into long-term memory, you remember it forever. But unless you see it and have a way to create a mnemonic so that it turns into a picture for you, you don't remember it necessarily.
100%.
Wow. So would that explain why I would always go to class and I would take copious notes and then I would redo my notes while I was writing them?
Right.
And then cards and cue cards
and
things like
that's
that.
That's one of the ways that I recommend visual spatials learn.
Oh, really?
Either that or illustrations.
Ooh.
And they cannot listen to a lecture and expect to take it in by listening to it. They have to either take, you know, copious, actually transcript kinds of notes, and then go back and pull out what's important.
Yes.
Because they see it.
Yes.
And so that's why things like computers that allow you to cut and paste, all of these things are so important to visual spatials and also tactile kinesthetics, that it makes all the difference in their ability to perform.
So is there four types total or just three?
There are three main types.
Okay.
There are theorists who have come up with many, many more types of intelligence. I'm sure you've heard of Gardner's multiple intelligences. Mm-hmm. We've brought it down to three types because these are the three that we've seen the most of that you can do something about.
I see.
The teacher can actually create a lesson plan that meets all three needs just by giving some options. Mm-hmm. Because it's really about not just how you take information, but also about how you demonstrate what you know. And so somebody who's visual spatial, they may want to demonstrate what they know in a creative way, or else they can't get themselves to do the work.
Right.
And so writing a report, they can get themselves if they're highly motivated and they don't have other learning challenges. Mm-hmm. But if they really want to do something wonderfully, they have to be able to put themselves and their creativity and their reaction to it all into however they demonstrate it. And so a lot of times there's a conflict between what the teacher wants. She wants everyone to write a report or a five-paragraph essay.
Yes.
And for a visual spatial learner, they're translating the picture they have in their head into words whenever they write. And so they write voluminously, or they can't organize their thoughts in a way that the teacher wants. And so that's not necessarily the best way to find out what that child knows. And if you give them an option to do something, create a PowerPoint or create a chart that demonstrates what they know, or a play or something that is more doing and showing, you get a completely different reaction.
So interesting, because I just had a first grade project for my son, and it was like the most terrifying thing on the planet for him. He had to write these questions and write sentences, and it was almost like he was a deer in headlights. I mean, he couldn't even and I think he's tactile the way you describe it, which I want to hear more about. But I mean, and I can imagine, like, if you don't think that like that, to sort of like, first of all, he doesn't like to do a lot of fine motor, so that was challenging. But then to imagine it on a huge poster board, I mean, it was like, I had to do a lot of it, you know?
And a lot of it is helping them organize because they have so many ideas coming in. I sort of describe the way visual, spatials, and tactile kinesthetics think as fireworks. Mm. They're not an outline. They don't think like an outline. Mm-hmm. They do not think in a sequential way. And so when you're thinking in fireworks, you can be going off in 90 different directions. And which one do you follow? Mm-hmm. You get overwhelmed.
Yes.
And especially if you're a child that has, you know, problems with fine motor skills so that the writing is a problem, you are challenged beyond your abilities. And teachers, they really try hard to give them the skills to organize themselves. That's why they do essays on, why they do projects that are designed to create an outline, that kind of thing. It's just not the way some of these kids organize. Their minds are not organized that way.
Curiously, are teachers in the public school systems educated on how to spot, like, early detection of these types of
not
issues?
Not usually.
So it's really about the parents.
It's usually about
attention.
The parents knowing and coming to someone like me where I can say, okay, here's the deal. You know, we need to get the teacher to do this. Linda Silverman and I and many people have written articles that are designed to tell teachers this is how you differentiate the program for them. But people who are usually good in school are the ones who become teachers. And to be good in school, you have to have been pretty auditory sequential because past third grade, things become very auditory.
Yes.
Oh.
And so the visual spatials, whether they're gifted or not, and the tactile kinesthetics, they have to really work harder once they get past third grade. And that's where you see a lot of emotional and behavioral problems come up because they're not being taught the way they learn. And when they have to be constantly getting the message that either they're stupid or they're just not following directions or something is wrong, then they lose confidence and they start acting out.
Right.
You know, is it harder or different between those who are, what's it called,
twice exceptional?
Twice exceptional versus those who are just once exceptional. I mean, somebody who just has ADD or a learning disability, but they're not super bright.
Absolutely. And it's, for parents, it is monumentally different because gifted children are normally asynchronous in their development. So they may be intellectually 20 years old and emotionally still their actual chronological age. And so what happens is the parent of a gifted child has to be constantly vigilant to respond to them in a way that doesn't patronize them because intellectually they understand everything that's going on, but that emotionally they don't get flooded because they're not yet prepared to understand an emotional concept, death or, you know, war or cruelty, those kinds of things. The twice exceptional have a worse problem because not only are they in the top, the gifted are in the top 1%, but the twice exceptional are in the lower one-third, depending on how serious their disability is. And so what ends up happening is the parents have to also be aware and advocate for a child who may be performing at grade level, when in fact they're capable of performing 3 years above grade level, but their disability is stopping them. And so the child is in a constant state of tremendous frustration. They know they're smart, but they cannot prove it.
This is my son. I'm like flipping out. Yeah, this is exactly it.
And you knew this way back when.
I did.
You've
knew when he
about
was
this for years.
I knew
like
when
right
he
out,
was
right out of the
I knew
right
I knew in the womb he was so active.
He
was like doing cartwheels in there. But no, I knew when he was one, and I remember he was like spinning around in the doctor's office. Like he needed constant stimulation. And I remember like I would be out with like my mom's, you know, all the new moms, and they'd all be like relaxed, and I would be like sweating because like he always needed something. Like, you know, he just was like one of those high needs kids from the start. You know, you just kind of know, I guess, as a mom.
Well, and the gifted can be very high need because just as you'd have like the difference between a $3,000 stereo and a $30 stereo, the fine tuning of their senses is also hugely fine tuned, and so they may be highly sensitive to noise, or they may be highly aware of light or just nuance, yes, because they are taking from the time they're born, uh-huh, depending on how gifted they are. And there's a huge range, yeah, between a child who's a 132 IQ, which is the beginning of gifted, and all the way up to, we can measure above 200. Mm-hmm. But the difference even between 132 and 145, which is gifted versus highly gifted,
yeah,
is huge.
Oh,
just
really?
Huge. Yeah. And so parents that have kids that are in one of these upper ranges, they have even more challenges. And so when you add to it any learning challenge,
yeah,
you are practically guaranteed, wow, to be in a battle with the schools to, yes, get the child the needs that they need. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not the school's fault. They don't have the means,
sure,
to meet a classroom that has a range of 8 grade levels.
Right.
Sure. And especially when the one who is the highest also can't sit still.
Yes.
And so to their credit, they do their best.
Uh-huh.
But for teachers, if they're not mature in their own work and their own personal identity, yeah, they'll consider that child who's the highly gifted one that asks all the questions, mm-hmm, but doesn't get his work done, complete thorn in their side.
Right.
And, yeah, it's, and scapegoating is not uncommon. So, you know, mm-hmm, I when I talk to teachers, which I frequently do in services about learning style or about, mm-hmm, twice exceptional, you know, I'll say, look, you have the opportunity to be that one teacher that, you know, I'm sure you remember him or her that, wow, made your life fabulous, who really saw you and encouraged you, mm-hmm, and made you want to be an art history major, mm-hmm, or whatever it was. Or you can be the teacher that made your life a living hell.
It's a great point.
And mm-hmm, it is not, yeah, that different, you know, when you have this, it is a choice.
Uh-huh.
And so a lot of these kids, especially the highly gifted, do get stigmatized, and the teachers, you know, don't like them.
How would you recommend, if a parent right now is listening to this and, mm-hmm, has a sense that she or he has a child that's exceptional, mm-hmm, or has a learning disability or something, mm-hmm, what's the best words for that parent to use with the child, maybe in little developmental blocks, like let's say a child that's 3 to 5 or a child, mm-hmm, from 5 to 8. What would be some of the...
Well, I think that when they're very young, because most of the testing isn't really accurate until they get a little older, and schools, in fact, frequently will not even assess them until they're 3 years behind, which a lot of the twice exceptional never...
Oh, my gosh. Wow. Interesting.
And they won't provide services unless they actually are failing classes and have, you know, significant behavioral, uh-huh, issues as well. So when you have a child who you know is so bright, but for some reason they just can't seem to learn to write, or they just can't seem to learn to add, that's when you hire a professional who can say, okay, what's normal here? Mm-hmm. I had a teacher, a professional teacher, whose child, it turned out, was horribly dyslexic and had visual processing problems, and she thought he was lazy because he was not learning to read by fourth grade. And once I gave him an achievement test, which this is a quantitative test, which I will also sometimes give to prove to the school, look, this child is able to do this at eighth grade and this at first grade.
Mm-hmm.
When I do that, I analyze how they answer the questions and what mistakes they make, and that's how I infer what else might be going on. Because otherwise, you can't always know, and especially, right, in little ones, there are very few ways to find out. We're getting better and better, mm-hmm, at early identification, but most of the time, a child goes to preschool, and unless there's a significant difference, the parent just thinks of it as a personality difference or as an, mm-hmm, activity level difference, mm-hmm, or, oh, you know, my kid's a real boy. I had people say, you know, compared to, you know, when seeing, yeah, you know, my son at that same age, uh-huh, they go, well, your son is just, you know, a wimp and mine's a real boy. Mm-hmm. Well, no, a few years later, the child was identified with ADHD,
right,
and, you know, and mine was identified with gifted. And that's why you saw this huge behavior gap.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there are differences, and if you are trained, you can see them.
Right.
I can go into a restaurant and say, that child is gifted, but there's something going on.
Did you follow me? Because that's like every time we're in a restaurant, I think everyone can know about my kids. That's really funny.
Not everyone.
Yeah.
No, not everyone, but some people.
Yeah.
Can, if they have enough experience with children.
Sure.
And, you know, I will say sometimes the parent, because there's such a difference in their learning style or their own experience of school, and they have agendas, you know, sometimes they will make the situation a little worse.
Sure.
Because, mostly because they just don't know.
Right.
I believe what Virginia Satir believes, she's the mother of family therapy, that every parent does the best job they know how to do, but if they don't know, they cannot be expected to respond to it.
Sure.
And so that's what I do. I coach the parents. I give them this, you know, the qualitative assessment. I give them an explanation of what I believe is happening in the school or the classroom. Mm-hmm. And then I just make recommendations. Look, you don't want them in a school like this. You want them in this kind of school.
Sure.
And I will give them, I developed a checklist when my kids, when I was looking for schools, because I observed 65 schools. I was one of those parents. Mm-hmm. And I had to have a way to know what I was looking at in the schools. And so I have a whole checklist. And it's available on the internet. It's called In Search of the Perfect Program. And it tells you the kinds of things for a gifted school you would want. And for your own child, when I do the qualitative, I look at it and I say, okay, your child is a klutz. Let's face it. You want a playground. This has to be tantamount. When you're
right.
looking at the schools, the playground has to be safe. It has to be supervised, you know, and the academics have to be this. And so I can
guide them that
guide
way.
Guide them yeah. which direction they need to go.
So for the parents out there listening, or for even, you know, kids, can you give maybe a couple recommendations in the classroom based on each of the learning styles that would be helpful?
Sure. Auditory sequential kids learn by hearing, and they're very good at learning things sequentially. So you want to teach them step by step.
Okay.
Visual spatials need to know what's the goal, what's the big picture, and then they will find the steps that they need, not necessarily in the order. I mean, one of the things about my book, you don't have to read the chapters in order.
Ha, that's great.
You don't have to even read the text, which is mostly for visual spatial, for auditory sequentials. Mm. You get anecdotes so that visual spatials can picture how to do what they need to do. And there are activities that allow a tactile kinesthetic to practice.
Right.
And a tactile kinesthetic is somebody who is particularly physical. They're aware of their environment, how their body feels, how their movement. They need to move and be doing.
Mm-hmm.
So for a tactile kinesthetic, you may want them to be able to have the choice to be the paper monitor, and when they need to move, get up and go pick up papers quietly.
Mm-hmm.
Or you may need them to be able to do a science experiment where they're actually doing something, and they're just following the directions, or they have an outcome that they need to find. A lot of times you find both visual spatial and tactile kinesthetic, they cannot show their work for math because they sort of scoot past it. They kind of know the answer. So getting them to do something backwards where you give them, okay, the result is six. Let's give us how many
that's
ways can you show six.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
And so it's allowing them to use their incredible problem solving and inferential skills to demonstrate that they are capable of learning this and that they know the basics of how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But showing their steps is harder. So going backwards will sometimes help them.
That makes sense.
So this is hysterical. I'm sitting here just dying laughing inside because Christopher, who's my guy, is always teasing me because I can't walk into a store without touching things. So
really?
I have to touch. Like if there's a blanket, if it's soft, I have to touch it. If there's a candle, I want to touch what it feels like. If there's something mushy, I want to feel what it feels like. So now I get to tell him that, look, I'm perfectly normal. I'm just a tactile kinesthetic learner.
Absolutely. And the thing to remember about TKLs.
I like that.
Okay.
Yes.
TKLs.
About
like
TKLs is that they, that's good. Tickle,
yeah.
I like that.
The tickle.
Is that if they're physically not at their best, they will not be able to pay attention. They will not be able to manage their emotions.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be aware. If they're hungry, feed them now.
Oh, my God. This is so amazing.
If they're sleepy, make sure that they have a chance to have downtime. If they're an introvert, Do not put them in environments where there are a lot of people in the room, where they're going to be at their worst.
This is amazing because I'm like flipping out because my son, I just said to my husband the other day, I'm like, we need to feed Remy every 2 hours. Like he's like Absolutely. An iguana, like I need to like he will like completely shut down. And it was so funny because my husband took him the other day to Castle Park and they were playing and I forgot to say to my husband, like, oh, make sure that you feed him. And so he takes a picture of my son, like literally like laying out in the parking lot, like just had completely lost it.
Oh no.
Like meltdown. Right. And I'm like, well, did you feed him? And he's like, no. Oh. And I'm like, yep. Uh-huh. Like he needs to be fed every Absolutely. 2 hours or else he like goes nuts.
And a combination of protein and carbs.
Yes.
They cannot exist. They want to exist on carbs.
Yeah.
I mean, they're frequently. And interestingly enough, I found that TKLs love meat.
Yes. This is so funny. I'm like flipping out. This is my son.
They love to chew. There's something about it. And so, you know, giving them that ability to chew and to, and the hardest part is they're usually very picky eaters because the texture of what they eat is as important as the taste. So you could cook something. It's their favorite food 7 days in a row. And on the eighth day, you put a little bit less liquid in it. They will not eat it.
That's fascinating.
This is like you are describing him perfectly. It's like scaring me. So you can only imagine, like I've got like all this stuff and then the pickiness. Yes. And so it's like, oh, it's a lot. It's a lot of work.
And one of the things that's so powerful about knowing what goes with it is that when it happens, you can say, did you feed him?
Yes.
Instead of just stop acting like this.
Exactly.
You know, because they cannot control themselves if they don't have, if they're not physically well.
Yes.
I mean, when they're sick, if they have a little fever, forget it. You cannot expect them to sit in a classroom and listen.
Yes. This is exactly. I'm now, like,
is
I know.
Is Remy attentive enough to his own body cues at this point in this age to be able to say, I'm hungry when he's hungry?
Not
or doesn't
so
usually
much.
Know.
No. And I'm always like, how do you not know? My stomach reminds me. But like, I don't know if he recognizes it almost too late or.
Well, he is busy.
Yes.
He's gifted.
Yes.
And the gifted are busy taking in information every minute, every place that they go. And a tactile kinesthetic is taking in more than just what they see or what they're told. They're taking in the temperature, the feeling of the desk, the size of the room, all of these things that affect their body consciousness and their comfort. So they don't, unless you teach them mindfulness.
Yes.
And sort of teach them the habits of noticing, okay, I'm not happy right now. What's going on in my body? Am I tired? Yeah. Am I hungry? Am I thirsty? They won't know because they're way too busy with life. And they do experience life just so fully. And when you're raising a child like this, the thing that excites you most is that, you know, they see a fur rug and they roll in it. And, you know, they will see a bunch of leaves and they will jump right in the pile. They live life in this physically exciting way.
This is exactly it.
It doesn't mean that they go inside.
Right. Well, and it's interesting, the term twice exceptional, because I really feel like Remy in particular is so exceptional. And I've talked about this on the show. I mean, the way he thinks and just sort of, I mean, my husband and I, like we feel, I mean, we feel so blessed to have both of our kids. And I think we both feel, we really love his thinking, especially. It's just so cool to like, just kind of hear what he comes up with and, you know.
And that's very common, what I hear from gifted parents.
Oh, really?
And gifted kids.
Yeah.
Yeah, because their whole way of looking at the world is usually a little bit askew compared to the average. So they're constantly identifying things and relating it to something they already know in a new way. And so it's fascinating. Sure. And when they're verbal, because some of them are not verbal early, but if they're expressive, so like an extrovert would be more expressive, their ideas are fascinating.
Yes.
And you know, if you have the attention span and you're not too angry because of their behavior issues, you know, you just love them to pieces.
Yes.
I mean, it's the reason I love to work with this population because I get to spend 2 hours in the life of these kids. I come to the parents' house because I get more information about the child by seeing their room and their environment. And I get to spend a couple hours being in this child's world and just hearing whatever they want to tell me that's important to them. And it is like
So non-judgmental and compassionate and loving and gives them the freedom to really express themselves.
It is. And it is, for me, I just feel my heart just open and explode with joy that these people are on this earth.
Oh,
and so
sweet.
I just love them. I mean, you know, that's why I work with this group.
It's such a cool group. Yeah.
And I think my enthusiasm helps the parents see their child from a different
way.
Perspective.
But I always say, like, not to toot my own horn here, but I do say I feel like there was a reason I was like this kid's mom, because I am fascinated by it. And I could see going completely the other way, that if I didn't have that positivity, that I could get extremely frustrated and, you know, and, you know, all
and
that
you're
kind of
really good with him.
Oh,
they really are.
They're good kids. They're a lot of work, but they're good kids, you know, and I see I see their benefits and I see their limitations too.
And you have to see both.
Yes.
And which is why, you know, as Anna Marie didn't really look at the limitations. She wanted to mostly talk about their wonderful gifts. Mm-hmm. But I feel as though if I see it, the parents really need to know, because otherwise I had one parent say, "You've given me permission to be patient with him now." Mm-hmm. And if you don't see it, you can't make accommodations for them, because so many of these disabilities or challenges are contextual.
Yes.
Well, it seems like parents get so caught up in the shame of it. You know, they're so worried about how somebody else, their neighbor or their best friend, is going to interpret their own intervention with their child that they usually do the classic, well, you know, he's just being snarky today, or he's just, you know, just making excuses.
Sure.
But designing it in a way that's not really understanding the child and the child's needs.
And I'm a big one for, you know, being very careful about the environments you take them into. Mm-hmm. You don't take a child who is not capable of sitting for a period of time into a library or into a place that,
the
movies
on Saturday night.
Right. You just
nice restaurant. Yeah. Right.
You, if you're going to do it, you do it for 15 minutes and you be prepared to go out and sit in the car the rest of the time.
Sure.
And I mean, I've sat out whole movies when one of my kids wasn't capable of staying in the movie with the rest of us. And I'd say, okay, I'll come see it another time. Even a, you know, a child's movie, you know, it's just like, sorry, if you don't behave this way, we don't get to stay here. And as long as the child doesn't feel that you're doing it to control them, that you're doing it because it's a logical consequence of their behavior and what they're capable of doing or not doing, and it's not punitive.
Yeah.
Then, you know, they're grateful for it.
I'll never forget this great moment in my life that was such a teaching experience. Was one of my really good friends. She was at my house and I was having a party for my daughter. I think she was 4. And it was just way too much for her. It was way, way too much. It was really more about me than about her. And she was just like, everybody go. I don't want anybody here. You know, just really unhappy because it had already been 2 hours at the bowling alley. Then everybody was coming back to the house for more and she's overstimulated. And I was like, okay, honey, you know, I just like was at my wit's end, but I was gentle, but I was just, I didn't know what to do. And my friend just said, to my daughter, she said, "Honey, it's okay. You're just not ready for this right now. Let's just go into another room and sit quietly." She took my daughter and they just sat quietly and I went in there and, you know, it was just such a beautiful moment of like, you know, we get so caught up in the moment of, you know, oh, my child isn't behaving.
Yes.
And it's going to make me look like a bad mom. And it's just, she was just doing her thing.
Exactly.
That's
exactly
right.
What she needed to be
doing.
Did you
ever read The Berenstain Bears Too Much Birthday?
No, but it's
about a 4-year-old birthday.
Oh, I should have read it before.
And I actually was very happy. I didn't make this up, but someone once told me that for birthday parties, if you have as many guests as the child is years. And you limit it in terms of activities based on their developmental abilities.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty smart.
You know, and I went a step further. If it was a sleepover, it was half. So, half the kids.
Half the kids.
So if they're
right.
4 years old, they can have 2 for a sleepover or 4 for a party.
That's smart.
Yeah.
That's
like
actually
it.
Really smart. I never thought about that.
And it's manageable. And then they don't get overwhelmed. And they learn how to decide who their best friends are.
Sure.
And who is really valuable that they would want at their birthday.
It is so hard to believe, but we're running low on time and we haven't talked about your book at all. So,
well, we did a little bit because you talked a lot about the learning styles, but let's highlight it exactly for the readers. It's
called Peace Within, Peace Between, your relationship tool book, easy to use applications of the theories of Virginia Satir, the founder of Family Therapy, by our guest today, Linda Powers Levitin. And tell us a few little snippets about it.
The book is very practical in orientation. The main message of it is that everyone wants to be their authentic selves and that they should create an environment where they can be and have optimum relationships. And all it takes to do that is to have some very simple skills down and to practice them. And so the book is very practical. Every chapter has a particular skill that it teaches. Every chapter has anecdotes about and jokes, a lot of them are jokes, that demonstrate one of the concepts. And then at the end of each chapter, there's a self-administered exercise that you can do just to open your consciousness about your experience, about your resources, about all of the things that you can use to be your authentic self and be successful in relationships. And the goal is to allow people to have the most loving and placid families and partners and be able to be themselves and be expressed in a way that's positive.
And it looks like it's really useful both for therapists, teachers, as well as just between you and your partner.
Absolutely. The exercises are very specific to something you can do yourself, or you can do with a partner, or you can do with your family, or as a therapist, you can assign them.
I think this is so great because I feel like just being aware of everybody else's learning style, personality style, you have such a different level of acceptance because it's like, okay, wow, I can see that they're not looking at it from this way. They're looking at it from this way. And I can see how I look at it from this way. And it's just, you know, more empathy.
Totally see how it turns out in fights, right?
Yes.
Why people are fighting and how they're fighting, because one is really trying to convey something and the other one's just not hearing it
not getting it that way
and does not know how to express it differently.
And in personality style, which is the Myers-Briggs, is one that most people are familiar with, there are very simple accommodations that you can use when you have a big difference. But unless you know that that's a difference, you interpret it as the other person, you know, not understanding you. And I always, like, I use an example for the for personality difference that if someone is a perceiving type, a strong perceiving type, which is somebody who likes open-endedness and likes to, you know, have their options open and they may not be very timely, and they're married to a judging type who likes to be early to everything, wants everything closed, decisions made, take separate cars to the airport.
That's really smart.
That one thing will reduce so much conflict and make vacations so much better.
I'm thinking of a couple in my head. This is so smart. Yeah.
And that's the kind of small change. And it may seem like it's an inconvenience, but it's so worth it.
It's worth it, yeah.
And there, and as soon as you know that you have to just accommodate those things and just say, look, I know you're being a perceiving type right this minute, but here's what I need.
I love that.
As long as you acknowledge it, the other person is going to be more likely to open up their hearts and be able to respond to what you need.
We just give me projects in the car because I'm the more judging type. Like I want things organized and on time and all of that when I'm in those situations. So when Christopher's driving, I just have a project. I either am looking up our next vacation, I'm making reservations, I'm doing something so that I'm busy doing something at my leisure.
Smart. That's smart.
And you know, and you know, people joke, but I'll say, look, when they have to have their list, just say, look, I'm just being a J, and you know I need my list, and just humor me.
I love this. And would you consider yourself an extrovert? Because I could see you almost both. It's sort of interesting.
I think historically, well, as a child, I was the shyest.
Introvert.
Oh, my God. I was just so shy and so shame-based that I don't even know what the hell I was. But as I got more comfortable with myself, I was definitely much more of an extrovert. As I get older, I find myself refueling less around other people and more internally. But I still really enjoy being around people.
Sure.
My neighbor and I were just talking about that
this
morning.
That's so
funny. Yeah.
And all of those are a range.
Yes.
I mean, you don't, not one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, really?
In the context of introvert, extrovert, it's about your energy level, as you were saying.
Yes.
If you're a strong introvert, you just know that when you're with people, you can act like an extrovert for a certain period of time, but then you need to leave and refuel.
But your fuel tank is dropping. Right, exactly.
Exactly.
I know a lot of people like that.
Yeah.
You can see almost after they're done with crowds, they just look worn out. So, well, we got to wrap up. Oh, my God.
This
is so much fun.
But everybody check out Linda Powers Levitin, her book, Peace Within, Peace Between, your relationship toolkit, and giftedandcreativecounseling.com. Is that where they can find everything about you?
All kinds of things.
And creativecounseling.com. Next week.
Next week, I'm very excited. We have the nephews of the famed Jackson 5 on. So that'll be great. And they're on that Lifetime show, Jackson 5, the next generation. So that'll be really, really exciting.
Yeah, we'll mustered that one up out of your butt somewhere.
It's kind of cool, right? Yes. Yeah, it's really interesting.
Very exciting.
Cool.
We're going to focus more on them, though, and not their historical
uncles. Yes, exactly. Yes. All right, cool. We'll see you guys then. Thank you so much.
Have a great week.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.